Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is the 1A Podcast. I'm Jen White, and you're listening to the News Roundup. It's 1 year into the Biden presidency, and he marked it with his first solo press conference in 10 months. He spoke for nearly 2 hours on everything from COVID to Ukraine to the Democrats' failure to pass a slew of his legislative priorities. So what did we learn? And after one pretty tough year, what's ahead for Biden and the Democrats? Joining us this week, Susan Page, the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Her latest book is Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Susan, such a pleasure to have you.
Hey, it's great to be back with you.
Also with us, Lauren Weber, the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Claudia Grisales, NPR's congressional reporter. Claudia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the number of new COVID-19 cases has begun to dip in 7 states across the U.S. It's a hopeful sign that the Omicron surge is slowing, but that comes as the death toll heads toward 2,000 people per day. Lauren, how likely is it that we are at least closing in on the peak of Omicron cases?
You know, I think it's a little too early to say definitively, but I will say that in the areas that were hardest hit with Omicron, you are starting to see a definite leveling off of cases. So New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., their cases are going down pretty dramatically. And nationally, the numbers are on the downtick. That said, you know, look, I'm based in St. Louis, Missouri. We are starting to really get into the heat of it now. This virus and variant is definitely hitting different parts of the country at different times. So severe stress is still happening in other places around the country.
And why are we seeing so many deaths per day?
You know, as has been true throughout the pandemic, deaths operate on a lag, right? You know, as hospitalizations rise, unfortunately, deaths then rise a couple weeks later. And we've seen an uptick of hospitalizations unlike any that we've had during the pandemic. And even though Omicron is, at a population level, a milder variant, has milder disease, when you have so many more hospitalizations, you're more likely to have more deaths. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing play out today.
Well, as you say, hospitals in the U.S. continue to be overwhelmed, and it's a topic we got into earlier this week with Dr. Megan Ranney.
The reality is when there are no staffed beds available, there are no staffed beds available, and it has an impact on not just patients with COVID, not just patients coming into the emergency department, but patients who have been counting on desperately wanted and needed surgeries, and their families and caregivers. And the effects of this are going to be felt for months, if not years, to come.
You can find that conversation at the1a.org. We'll also tweet out a link at 1A. America is seeing more hospitalizations now than at any other point in the pandemic, and more than other wealthy countries. Why is the U.S. a global outlier here, Lauren?
So, unfortunately, the U.S. has lower vaccination rates than a lot of the other major countries in the world. And unfortunately, we also have lower booster rates. Only about 63% of the U.S. has been vaccinated with 2 shots, and only about 39% have received a booster in comparison to European countries and others that have much higher rates. I also suspect, too, the U.S. is typically a more unhealthy population. We have higher rates of obesity, heart disease, and other conditions that would be severely exacerbated by these huge numbers of COVID cases. So you're seeing that population level issues play out on a larger scale when you're looking at these higher hospitalizations for the United States.
Now, Susan, the White House is hoping to combat the surge by making tests and masks available for free. This week, the administration launched a website where Americans can order up to 4 free at-home rapid tests per household. How has the rollout gone so far?
Well, it's just begun. I'm not sure anybody has seen actual these tests arrive at home. And one of the things the president acknowledged at his news conference this week was that they were slow in dealing with the need to provide really widespread testing, and now also government being willing to distribute high-quality masks to American households. You know, this is really, this is the most fundamental challenge that the Biden White House faces today. In a world with a lot of challenges, from Russia to Build Back Better to voting rights, I think getting control of COVID and this Omicron variant that has swept the country is the issue that is making everything else the White House hopes to do harder. And that's one reason I think we saw the president address this as job one at the news conference that took place on the eve of the first anniversary of his inauguration.
Lauren, what do people need to know to get access to these tests?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a free website, or there's a website that you can access, then you can order 4 tests per household. The administration actually just announced this morning that there's also a hotline you can call, and I'll read that number. It's 800-232-0233. You can also call that number from, I believe it's 8 to 12 Eastern or midnight Eastern to receive your 4 free COVID tests per household. And just to echo Susan, you know, as Biden stressed, this is a fantastic movement, but it is a little late in the Omicron surge. So, you know, it's great to have these tests on hand, and any bit of testing and surveillance testing to keep folks isolated and quarantined after exposure is fantastic, but we don't yet have those tests in hand.
Now, as we said at a rare press conference on Wednesday, President Biden did acknowledge some of those missteps you've mentioned when it came to the government's COVID response.
Should we have done more testing earlier? Yes, but we're doing more now. We've gone from 0 at-home tests a year ago to 375 million tests on the market in just this month.
Claudia, what has the administration said about why there was a delay around getting testing and masks available to the American people?
Yeah, it seems like it took the administration some time to get their arms around this issue. We even saw members of Congress of his own party, Democrats, issuing statements saying the administration needed to move quicker on this and get these at-home tests to more Americans. And now we're seeing the masks being distributed as well. And so it seems the administration took some time to get its arms around this issue and is playing catch up now.
Lauren, as we said, the White House is also distributing 400 million free N95 masks at pharmacies and health centers across the country. When you look at where we are right now, and this ramp up of free tests and masks, is it going to be enough to slow the spread of Omicron?
I think it'll certainly help with a dent. But, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, this would have been really helpful to have in December as Omicron was really ramping up. But, you know, higher quality masks absolutely have an impact on stopping the spread of Omicron. It is always better to have a higher quality mask like an N95 or a KN95 as opposed to a cloth mask, as they are just much more effective at blocking virus particles. So, you know, look, it's always great to have a free mask, and hopefully this will help bring the downswing even more.
Claudia, where is the White House bumping up against states and what states are saying in terms of mask mandates or blocking mask mandates or what should be happening in schools?
Yeah, there is some counter-programming that we're seeing across the country. In Virginia, for example, with a new governor, Glenn Youngkin, taking office just a few days ago and erasing the mandate of mask wearing in schools. And schools, meanwhile, are battling the governor and saying, no, we're going to continue our mask mandates. So, yes, there is some counter-programming here with the president trying to tout the use of these higher quality masks, trying to push other steps such as the testing, what have you. But there are states that we're seeing here going in different directions. So it's kind of an issue that now is highlighting the divide, if you will, between what the White House is pushing and what some of these states want to do.
Claudia, and refresh our memories, are there any federal level rules regarding masking in schools?
There are no federal level rules, and even with states that try to push that into place, for example, what we just saw again in Virginia, perhaps there is some sort of mandate, but it can be erased with the change of a political party in that governor's office.
And Lauren, what does the science say about, for instance, the effectiveness of masking in the classroom?
You know, the science, I think even beyond the science too, the science definitely would point out that masking in the classroom can reduce spread and certainly can keep kids in school. And I think that's the important part that a lot of scientists and public health experts have pushed for, is that if you have a kid that is masked, then the chance of how long they need to be quarantined for or isolated certainly can change. So a lot of experts, you know, are sad to see such mask mandates go for kids, because it could mean that more of them have to be sent home from school if they are exposed to COVID.
It seems, and we hear this from listeners quite a bit, that most of the pandemic we've been reacting to surges, personal behavior. How can federal and state governments actually get ahead of future surges? Susan, your thoughts?
Well, they're trying to monitor whether the new variants emerge. We heard Tony Fauci talk yesterday about the need to keep up a really robust set of research and development of new vaccines. So far we've been lucky that both the Delta and the Omicron variant have been able to be controlled by the vaccines that most Americans were already receiving. But it's a concern. Who knew that COVID, that we would be going into a third year of COVID and COVID restrictions? I think it's the most dismaying thing you can say to Americans today.
We're rounding up the week's top stories with Susan Page of USA Today, NPR's Claudia Grisales, and Lauren Weber of Kaiser Health News. We'll get into more of the week's biggest headlines after the break. And remember, to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're rounding up some of the week's biggest headlines. Let's get back to the conversation. This latest COVID surge is straining staff resources at schools across the country. This week, the governor of New Mexico announced plans to train state National Guardsmen to step in as substitute teachers and childcare providers. Here's Democratic Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham.
Superintendents and principals will make decisions about who is at their school. We're giving you a pool. We're not going to tell you who fits what criteria.
Susan, the move comes as the state continues to shatter daily COVID case numbers. What's going on here?
Well, we're finding states really struggling, both in some places to get teachers to go back into the classroom. In other cases, just because of the high levels of illness, COVID illness among staffers. One of my kids is a middle school teacher, and his school had to go to remote learning for 2 days because there weren't enough adults to properly monitor the school just because of the spread of COVID. So New Mexico is just one of the states that is trying to figure out ways to deal with this, because there are some things we've learned after 2 years of COVID. And one is that it's important for kids to be in school to figure out how to make that happen, not just because it keeps their parents from going crazy, but because it's good for their own education levels. And it's almost as though New Mexico must look like you're on a war footing, right? If you call out the National Guard to try to make it possible to keep your schools open. That's the place where we are now.
How have other states been handling these staffing dilemmas?
Well, other states have had a variety of approaches. Some have deputized adults who are not teachers to be either substitute teachers or to provide a supervisory role. We've seen schools offer incentives to get people to drive school buses. I mean, the problem with COVID is that it has hit people who do all sorts of jobs that are crucial to keeping schools open. And of course, there have been some places where teachers' unions have expressed concern about the health of teachers and have resisted some of the orders to get the classrooms back with in-person learning. This is not confined to one state. I suspect that there is not a school district across the country that has not had to take some measures to try to deal with this.
Lauren, a lot of these conversations are discussed through the lens of teachers and parents, but what about students? What are they saying about what's happening right now?
You know, you have a variety of reactions. You have kids that want to be in school no matter what, but kids that often also feel unsafe in the classroom. Imagine you go to school and every adult is out sick. I can't imagine that you would feel very safe sitting there, you know, as kids are coughing around you potentially. So I think there's a variety of issues at play. And just to echo some of what Susan said, you know, even in Missouri right now, since the emergency order for COVID has been declared null by the governor, you know, if Missouri kids have 5 or more days of virtual school, they have to make up those days in the summer on the back end in person. So a lot of schools are doing everything they can to only have short virtual school interruptions because they don't want to make up the days on the back end. And these are the realities that schools across the country are having to deal with these days.
We got this tweet from Anastasia, who says there needs to be more sequencing done with the virus so that this country might get ahead of variants. And we should mention here that Omicron was first identified in South Africa. They have a very sophisticated sequencing program there. But Lauren, how does the U.S. measure up when it comes to sequencing?
And look, here's what you need to know about the U.S. healthcare system. It runs on faxes, and that's everything you need to understand about how outdated we are when it comes to technology, sequencing, and anything that has to do with public health in this country. Our data mechanisms are incredibly outdated. Our ability to get data from the states is incredibly crippled. And there's a reason we often look to other countries and Israel for data on these issues, because they have much better data tracking systems.
Is there any effort or even conversation about updating the systems that could help us get out of this pandemic?
Certainly. I mean, you saw Senator Romney ask about this in a congressional hearing, I think a couple weeks ago, but there is conversation. I think there is money that's being talked about, but not yet has this been fixed. And it's pretty sad considering we're nearing, as Susan pointed out, year 3. So it is certainly something that needs to be addressed for the nation's health in the future.
That's Lauren Weber, the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
NPR's Claudia Grisales and Susan Page of USA Today are sticking with us. Now let's shift to politics. President Biden marked his first full year in office on Wednesday at his first solo news conference in 10 months. Biden addressed the disappointment of failing to pass many of his administration's legislative priorities, but put the blame squarely on his Republican colleagues.
I didn't overpromise. But I think if you take a look at what we've been able to do, you'd have to acknowledge we made enormous progress. But one of the things that I think is something that one thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country.
Here's a couple of messages we got. JD emailed, when we claim Biden hasn't delivered on his promises, are we just giving ourselves an out to acknowledge our responsibilities? He can't get COVID under control. We have to do what is smart. He can't pass legislation unless the voters tell their representatives and senators what they want. Are we doing those things or just sitting back and blaming Biden? And AC tweeted, it should be clear to everyone now that Manchin and Sinema are Republicans and will continue to side with their leaders, McConnell and Trump. However, President Biden doesn't need Congress to cancel student debt, lower drug prices, or to decriminalize or deschedule cannabis. Claudia, two different perspectives there. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it may fall in the middle of those two. There are folks who see Biden as having a very, very difficult first year where he was not able to make that connection, that he didn't have Republicans he could rely on, and there would have to be more aggressive steps in terms of working around that kind of opposition. It's a divided Senate, and you need 60 votes for a lot of these major pieces of legislation to pass. And so perhaps that's an acknowledgement he was making there in that comment that was played. state that he didn't have the kind of bipartisan support that perhaps he would have seen when he was in the Senate. It's a new day, and there's new levels of partisanship on Capitol Hill, and he has to maneuver around that along with members of his party. And that's kind of the reality that they're crashing into this year and trying to figure out how to get through this, how to get past this and move those big marquee pieces of legislation.
Susan, so far, how much of his campaign agenda has Biden been able to accomplish?
Well, he's done some big things. Remember, in March, Democrats passed that big COVID relief package. The bipartisan infrastructure bill got passed. That was a big achievement. He has reasserted the importance of traditional U.S. alliances around the world. But there's no question he's also fallen short on some of the things he promised Americans he would do. One is on addressing the voting rights legislation. I realize that has united Republican opposition, but it's something that Biden talked about. And I think the fundamental failure of his administration in his first year was he campaigned, and then when he took office, talked about he could break through this fierce partisanship that's divided us into tribes. He had the experience on Capitol Hill to forge bipartisan coalitions to get things done. And that has proved to be very, very difficult. And that was something he said in his news conference. He blamed Republicans for not having an agenda. He blamed Republicans for the united opposition in language he hasn't used before. That is an acknowledgement, I think, that his promise of bipartisanship was naive and outmoded and something we all aspire to. We wish it were true, but it's turned out not to be true. And I think he acknowledged that on Wednesday, that we're just at a stage in our country where it seems impossible for Democrats and Republicans to work together.
Well, in more politics and in a move that surprised no one this week, Senate Democrats failed to get rid of the filibuster and as a result didn't get that much discussed voting rights legislation passed. Ahead of the vote on Wednesday evening, there was a passionate debate over the bill on the Senate floor. Here's Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina and Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey.
Realizing in South Carolina the minority turnout was stronger than the overall turnout in South Carolina. And two of the three African-American senators in the United States Senate today, two of us, represent those southern states. It's hard to deny progress when two out of three come from the southern states that people say are the places where African-American votes are being suppressed.
You want to know what's going on in Georgia right now? They have a historical pattern of dwindling polling places in the diverse areas, with some voters in Georgia waiting up to 10 hours in predominantly black neighborhoods. Think about this for a second. You want to talk about voter suppression?
Susan, remind us briefly why the filibuster and this voting legislation are wrapped up in one another.
Well, the voting legislation has the united opposition of the Republican Party. It's not possible to get the 60 votes that you would need to get around a filibuster to allow it to be brought up for a vote. So there was a proposal made by its proponents that this issue is so important, the issue of voting rights, so fundamental to our democracy, that the Senate could carve out a kind of one-off exception to the filibuster to allow passage of this particular legislation. But at least two senators were uncomfortable with that and willing to support that. Manchin and Sinema, the names we've heard so often in reference to so many things coming before the Senate. So it wasn't possible to carve out this one-time exception that would allow Democrats only to pass the bill. It does have the united support of every Democratic senator, but the idea of undermining the filibuster, bypassing the filibuster for it, did not have united support. There is now a big discussion about the Electoral Count Act, which is a smaller provision, a more streamlined Voting Rights Act that addresses one particular problem that came up with January 6th, and that would be establishing clearer guidelines on what it is, how the electoral votes get counted, to eliminate that possibility that some in the Trump White House argued a way for the vice president to somehow upend the counting of electoral votes. And that's gaining some steam. It's not everything that that Democrats wanted to have on voting rights, but it would be something, and it has bipartisan support because of bipartisan concern about what they saw on January 6th.
We got this question from Michael, who says, are there specific items in the proposed voting law that would benefit the minority party, the Republicans? If there is no such language, why should a Republican support the proposed law? Now, Claudia, there are many who argue that voting rights legislation should be bipartisan because voting is a central tenet of our democracy. But how do you respond to Michael?
You know, it's very unlikely that this big voting rights package is going to pass by the midterms. And I think it does go to, it does allow some of these state laws that are being enacted now that Republicans say are designed to make the vote more secure and that Democrats say are designed to prevent only some people from voting. It makes it much harder for Democrats to oppose those laws. They have to fight them one by one, state by state, as opposed to having a federal law that would cover the whole country.
And Claudia, what about the political impact? Do we know how voters are looking at this?
You know, what we're hearing is that for a lot of voters, it is a critical issue in having that access, especially with what we saw January 6th and the threats to certifying the election's results for president. And so there are increased concerns there. And we've seen the lines. We've heard the stories about access being blocked for voters or curtailed, restricted. And so that is a concern out there. But at the same time, we're dealing with a pandemic. We're dealing with some major crisis in this country. And some folks have prioritized that more. They're focusing on where am I going to get my next gallon of milk? Where am I going to get my next paycheck? And so there are some more pressing issues that can eclipse this voting rights debate.
We're talking to NPR's Claudia Grisales and Susan Page of USA Today. Let's turn to the latest out of the House Select Committee's investigation into January 6th. On Wednesday, the Supreme Court rejected former President Trump's request to block some of his White House records from investigators. Susan, this is a major victory for the House Select Committee. It's been going after Trump's records for 6 months now. What do we know about these records and how they might shape the investigation?
Where they're going to give the committee a glimpse inside in what was happening inside the White House involving the president on January 6th. That is really important contemporaneous information. I think only one justice sided with Trump on this. It was nearly unanimous, including some of the justices he had appointed to the court. And some of that material has already been turned over to the committee. It's not an unexpected victory because people thought that the legal arguments that the former president were making weren't going to stand up. But it's the fact that it wasn't unexpected doesn't make it any less important. It's really a crucial victory for the committee as they head into the final months of their investigation.
Claudia, more broadly, what does the court's ruling indicate about the limits of executive privilege and other secrecy powers?
Well, that's an interesting part of the ruling. They admitted themselves that they were not in a position to try and delineate that line where a former president's claims to executive privilege to trying to block documents from another administration begin and where it ends. That is a question that remains open. We have not seen a legal fight like this between a sitting president and a former president. So that definitely opens the door to more debate here and concerns that future presidents may waive executive privilege, that is allowing documents to be released, whereas former presidents are opposed and trigger another legal fight. So that is a question that remains to be answered in the future.
We should mention that also this week, the House Select Committee issued another round of subpoenas to close allies of former President Trump, including one to his former attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Claudia, what will you be watching next in this investigation?
So it's really interesting as they get further into the former president's inner circle. For example, yesterday, the committee asked Ivanka Trump, his daughter, and the former White House senior advisor to appear before the committee. And it was included, this request, in a letter filled with new details that were uncovered so far in the investigation, such as Trump's conversations with his vice president at the time, Mike Pence, pressuring him to try to step out of his ceremonial role and try to stop the certification of President Biden's win. And so I'm looking forward to those new details, those continued details that we're going to see surface from the inner circle and those that will come from these documents that will be released to the committee, such as the video that Trump made and the takes that he made before that video was released and the difficulties he had on January 6th making that statement telling rioters to leave the Capitol.
That's Claudia Grisales, NPR's congressional reporter. Also with us today, Susan Page, the author of Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. She's also the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Claudia, Susan, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the 1A podcast. I'm Jen White, and this is the International News Roundup. Our guests today are Dave Lawler. He's the world news editor for Axios. Dave, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Also with us, Greg Myrie, NPR's national security correspondent. Greg, thanks for being here.
Hi, Jen.
And we're thrilled to welcome back to the Roundup Nina Maria Potts. Nina Maria is Global News Director for Feature Story News. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov met for 90 minutes earlier today with no major breakthroughs. However, Blinken promised Lavrov that the U.S. would respond to Russian demands over NATO in writing sometime next week. Dave, what further details do we have about those demands and what the U.S. response could look like?
Yeah, so there are three major Russian demands. One is that the U.S. and NATO rule out membership for Ukraine or really any further eastward expansion. The U.S. and NATO have both said that's a non-starter. They also want the alliance to roll back its positions in Eastern Europe, basically move. It's unclear exactly what would satisfy the Russians on that point. But again, it's not something that the U.S. has showed much openness to. And the third demand is to not put further offensive weaponry in Europe, or in particular in Ukraine. And maybe there's some flexibility on that point. But really, there's not a ton of common ground on these issues that Russia is raising. Although, as you mentioned, Secretary Blinken said the U.S. will respond to these in writing, which is something that the Russians have been insisting on for the past week or so.
Now, Greg, earlier this week, President Biden signaled the possibility of Russia invading Ukraine, saying, quote, "My guess is he will move in. He has to do something," end quote. Here's more from his press conference on Wednesday.
Russia will be held accountable if it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy.
So, Greg, the U.S. has already levied a series of economic sanctions against Russia. What's still on the table? What would make these new sanctions different?
Well, we don't know exactly what they would be. They're promised to be very, very harsh sanctions, and perhaps the most dramatic one that we've gotten wind of would be cutting Russia off from the international bank payment system, the SWIFT system. If you're not part of that system, you really can't do financial transactions around the world. Every major bank around the world is part of this, so that would be a huge deal. And in the Senate, Senate, there is some talk about this right now. There's some divisions about whether you should do sanctions before a Russian invasion or wait till after it happens. So they haven't agreed on a package, only the promise that they will be very, very tough sanctions. But also, it's also clear the U.S. is not going to send troops into Ukraine.
Well, there was swift reaction to the president's comments about what constitutes an invasion. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted on Thursday, quote, "We want to remind the great powers that there are no minor incursions and small nations, just as there are no minor casualties and little grief from the loss of loved ones. I say this as the president of a great power," end quote. Yesterday, both Press Secretary Jen Psaki and President Biden walked back the notion the U.S. would not respond to a so-called minor incursion. President Biden said, quote, "If any assembled Russian units move across the Ukrainian border, that is an invasion," end quote. He added it would result in a, quote, "severe and coordinated economic response." We also got this message from Phil, who emailed, "Kudos to Biden. Rather than draw a false line in the sand, he said, we'll evaluate when other people's lives are on the line. Speak the truth. American lives should not be part of the negotiations dealing with Ukraine." Dave, what type of support is Ukraine looking for from the United States and NATO?
Well, to Phil's point, I think it's interesting. Biden got a lot of criticism for saying outright that we would not send troops into Ukraine, but you could, I suppose, position that as being straightforward about a situation that we all kind of knew was not going to become a war between the U.S. and Russia. It would, in the end, be a war between Russia and Ukraine. In terms of what Ukraine is looking for, they definitely want sanctions now before a potential invasion rather than after. They would like sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that will carry gas from Russia to Germany, circumventing Ukraine and really taking away any leverage that Ukraine might have over Russia in terms of its gas exports. They also would like more weaponry. The U.S. is sending defense assistance to Ukraine. Biden has stepped that up even in the last month. They would like more. And they want basically as many signals of solidarity that the U.S. stands behind Ukraine as possible. You did see Secretary of State Blinken stop in Kyiv on his way to meet Lavrov in Geneva. That's another signal that the U.S. is standing by Ukraine. And so as much of that as possible is welcome from the Ukrainian perspective.
Now, President Biden argued it's unlikely Ukraine will fit the criteria to join NATO in the coming decade, given the country's levels of political and economic corruption. But Nina Maria, Russian President Vladimir Putin has called on the U.S. to ensure Ukraine never joins NATO, and he views the U.S. as the de facto leader of the organization. What rules are in place for admitting countries into NATO?
Well, I mean, the irony of this situation is that there's been an intense reluctance to let Ukraine in for the very reasons that you articulated. And, you know, clearly there are rules in place. But I think the bigger question is Biden's failure to get Europe more widely on the same page with regards to Russia and the appropriate response. I mean, Europe is deeply split on the question of how far it should go. Germany, especially, is less keen on confrontation. Despite the new coalition government, there's a degree of internal fighting there. The new government isn't unified on Russia. You could argue that the Russia-Germany deal over the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the gas pipeline, with Biden's backing last year, handed Putin a victory. It gave Putin the opportunity to isolate Ukraine further. I mean, if you've been listening to Blinken this week, he's been making very powerful statements. He's laid out the moral, ethical, principled objection to Russian aggression. And he made, I think, a very powerful speech and a show of unity alongside the German foreign minister this week. But at the end of the day, what on earth is even a united Europe? Even if it, you know, were united, and a united America, even if it were united, going to do about it? The European response right now looks at best scrappy. And although there have been some mobilization, Britain has been airlifting thousands of anti-tank missiles to Ukraine. Sweden has deployed armored vehicles to Gotland. And then there's the whole question of sanctions that Greg was breaking down for us. There is an awful lot of division. Macron has annoyed other European partners by telling the European Parliament that Europe needs its own dialogue with Russia, its own proposals for European security, which it would then share with NATO. So I think there are big questions that go well beyond the rules of NATO about the political divisions and Biden's failure. I mean, I almost feel like his biggest gaffe has been his inability to get on the same page as Europe.
Well, Dave, just explain exactly how much power the U.S. wields when it comes to NATO. How big of a stick do they carry?
When it comes to NATO, the U.S. is obviously the big power in the room, and that's part of the reason why the Russians want to deal directly with the United States over this. And so that's some of the resistance that Nina Maria was talking about on the European side, is that really when it matters, the Russians want the U.S. in the room. They don't want 27 different EU leaders speaking with different voices. And so when it comes to NATO, certainly the U.S. is the big power. But when it comes to the economic leverage over Russia, the Europeans actually have much closer economic ties on things like energy to Russia than the U.S. does, which is part of why Blinken and Biden are putting so much emphasis on a coordinated sanctions package between the U.S. and Europe. If Putin were to invade, that would be much more powerful than what the U.S. could do on its own. But as was just made quite clear, there is no consensus even within Europe or within the United States on what sanctions look like, let alone across both the U.S. and the EU.
A bipartisan group of senators traveled to Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, earlier this week to speak with President Volodymyr Zelensky. Here's Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio speaking with Radio Free Europe.
To the extent that the United States has increased our military footprint in Ukraine or in Eastern Europe, it is only because of Russian aggression in Eastern Ukraine and Crimea.
You know, we are very concerned with what we see, which is this massive Russian buildup along the borders and a sort of hybrid warfare where we see, as an example, the cyber attacks this week. So the United States is responding by helping Ukraine even more.
Now, Dave, Axios broke the news that President Zelensky told the group of senators that sanctions against a Russian invasion would be of no use to Ukraine. How is congressional leadership responding to the president's plan?
So it is a mix. And I think there are two things here. There is a level of unity, as you just heard from that clip, that we really need to do everything we can to deter Putin. And if he does move in, we need to, hit him hard, basically. But where the division is how you roll out those sanctions. So the Biden administration wants to basically lay out a broad picture of what the response will look like if Putin moves in. If he moves, then we trigger the sanctions. Republicans, most Republicans, want to do it in the opposite order. Sanction Putin now, and if he walks back from the ledge, we can revisit those sanctions. That is also the side of the equation that the Ukrainians come down on. And they're also warning, basically, that this is not just about the possibility of a massive Russian invasion, an attempt to occupy Ukraine. In fact, they've downplayed that risk a bit, maybe in part because their own citizens are so concerned. But they've also said, you know, you could see Russia move in both through cyber attacks, through operations in the east, where there are already regions that are controlled by Russia-backed separatists, that this is not, you know, we shouldn't just be watching the border and seeing when Putin moves across and then responding, that we need to be a bit more agile and also be willing to act in advance of a potential invasion. So that's the Ukrainian position.
Now, Greg, Russia also moved troops into Belarus earlier this week. They're engaged in joint military exercises on the country's western border. What concerns did that raise?
Well, it just increases the possibilities. And the Russian troops are on three sides, really, on the east of Ukraine, to the south, and to the north. And now in Belarus, which is to the north of Ukraine, you're pretty close to the capital, Kyiv. The Kyiv is only about 60 miles or so from the Belarusian border. So it would not be a long trip from there to the capital, and of course raises concerns if the Russians do go for an all-out attack or a major attack and try to seize the capital, Kyiv. A lot of the focus in recent years has been on the east, which is pretty distant from the capital. One little ironic note, if you will, if Russian forces do come across, about the first place you hit in northern Ukraine is Chernobyl. So you would literally be rolling right past Chernobyl on your way to Kiev. So the Russians can sort of pitch this as we're just doing military exercises with a friendly country in Belarus. But again, it just keeps expanding this Russian military footprint and increasing the possibilities about what kind of attack could take place. And again, nobody knows what Putin's plan is, whether he's just bluffing, whether he's looking for a limited sort of attack in the east, or whether he'll go for a larger attack and target the capital, Kiev.
We're rounding up some of the week's biggest news. And a reminder to have your questions answered on future topics, or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A. We'll be back with more after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This is the 1A podcast. I'm Jen White, and this is the International News Roundup. Well, there was much more beyond Russia and Ukraine that came up during President Biden's press conference on Wednesday. He was asked about ongoing talks with Iran, and the president told reporters progress is being made to revive the nuclear deal, which was scrapped by the Trump administration. Biden said, quote, "It's not time to give up," and added that the group of countries negotiating alongside the U.S. are on the same page. A former U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, is not on the same page. He told Fox News, where he's now a contributor, that the Biden administration seems to be begging Iran to enter another bad agreement.
It doesn't prevent the cataclysmic risk associated with Iran having a nuclear weapon. We were right to get out. Had we had four more years, I am confident the Ayatollah would have been faced with an incredible decision, difficult decision, about whether to capitulate at risk to his continued authority or to sign a deal with the Trump administration. I think they would have done that, and we would have gotten a deal that actually precluded Iran from enriching uranium in a way that threatened Israel and the United States.
The U.S. has told Iran the window for reviving the 2015 nuclear pact, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, is nearly shut. Nina Maria, what signs of progress are there right now?
Well, I mean, that actually is an important point, because if the U.S. is not ready to give up quite yet, as Biden says, that's not entirely the messaging that's been coming from the State Department, as you just basically indicated there, which has been saying that the runway is very, very short, weeks, not months. Antony Blinken has given a similar time frame. And there's no fixed deadline. But if there's also no progress over the next few weeks, the consensus is that there's a risk that the talks on the future of the nuclear deal will slip kind of deeper into a dangerous state of limbo. The blame, as far as the White House is concerned, lies with Trump for pulling out of the deal in 2018. The Biden narrative is that was a complete disaster. They're very clear that if this goes wrong, the Trump administration was entirely to blame. On the issue of time running out and what we know about the progress of the talks, one major factor is the sheer levels and rate of uranium enrichment. So the international community kind of needs to get on with it if the goals remain the same. We hear talk of being close to agreement, but it may be so limited in scope that it might not last very long. And Iran is still refusing to meet U.S. negotiators. So all talks in Vienna are being done through the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Russian delegations. But detail on the actual progress is, I think, very deliberately scant and low-key.
Well, Greg, we should note that also on Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin was playing host to his Iranian counterpart. How much do we know about the reasons for that meeting?
Well, I suspect the most prominent reason is these are two isolated countries, and what they have in common is a shared grievance with the U.S., obviously Russia over the Ukraine issue and Iran with the U.S. over the nuclear issue. And in fact, as they made a few remarks for TV, that's what they focused on. The Iranian leader, Ibrahim Raisi, the president, talked about the need for synergy between Russia and Iran to deal with American power. And so it seemed that was pretty much what was on their agendas, is showing that they could work together, that these countries that don't have a lot of friends, don't have a lot of allies, are trying to coordinate their efforts a little bit. They don't have a ton in common. Russia could invest in Iran's energy sector. Russia could sell some weaponry to Iran. But there's no real danger that these countries are going to form some powerful alliance. They also have a lot of differences. So I think this was a lot of this was PR and showing that they could get together and sort of jointly push back against the U.S.
Well, one last note from Wednesday's press conference was this response from President Biden. He was asked when he's ready to lift tariffs against China. They were imposed by former President Trump, and whether he's heard the concerns from American businesses who had hoped for more from his administration.
And that's why my trade rep is working on that right now. The answer is uncertain. I'd like to be able to be in a position where I could say they're meeting the commitments, more of their commitments, and be able to lift some of it. But we're not there yet.
Now, Greg, I know we've got to let you go, but briefly, with supply chain still an issue, what expectations are there that these tariffs will be lifted?
Right. Both countries have a need here. China's economic numbers that came out this week were not great. Its economy has been moving pretty slowly in the last half of last year and into this year. The U.S. certainly has this need to pick up on the supply chain issues. There was this limited agreement under the Trump administration where China was supposed to buy more U.S. goods and services. They haven't met those benchmarks. So if President Biden were to ease the sanctions or were to lift them, it would look like he'd be sort of giving in some sense to China. But on the other hand, he does want supply chain issues to be resolved. So this is going to be a tricky issue. I think both countries are a little bit vulnerable and would like to get past this, but they haven't hit any of the targets that they set for themselves.
That's Greg Myrie. He's NPR's national security correspondent. Greg, we know you have a lot to cover today. We appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jen.
And staying with us, Nina Maria Potts, Global News Director for Feature Story News, and Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios. Before we move on, I want to read this email we got from Lisa, who writes, couldn't a lot of international disputes, notably Russia and Ukraine, as well as North Korea and the U.S., be resolved with non-aggression agreements? Nina Maria?
That's a wonderful point. I mean, I couldn't agree more. It does feel like a particularly dark time, and security threats across the globe are looking increasingly worrying. In direct response to that, I couldn't agree more.
Dave, your thoughts?
It's very difficult politically, obviously, to tell Vladimir Putin that we'll never take certain actions towards him or Kim Jong-un. So there are difficulties there. And obviously, how trustworthy are those governments? I mean, yes, in general, I am in favor, as Nina Maria said, of any agreement that sort of walks us back from these various ledges in front of us. But obviously, there's a reason we haven't been able to come to those sort of agreements in the recent history.
Well, the first aircraft carrying humanitarian supplies arrived in Tonga on Thursday. That's a full 5 days after the nation was hit by a volcanic eruption in the South Pacific and a tsunami that devastated communities and contaminated most of its drinking water. Nina Maria, how much more do we know now? Communications have largely been cut off.
The comms situation is still very limited. Just to the point about how much aid has arrived, New Zealand and Australia were the first to send military transport planes with supplies, including generators and shelters. Staff were not allowed to come into contact with the residents, because Tonga's zero COVID policy has complicated the rescue effort. Japan has also contributed, you know, several countries around the world, including the United States. But the Australians and New Zealanders were the first to arrive. And certainly part of that has been the clearing of the runway from, you know, all the ash. But to the point of comms, one phone company, I think, has managed to restore international calls, or the ability to make international calls from some places in Tonga. And that has been absolutely crucial, because Tonga has a sizable diaspora overseas. And so those phone calls have been an absolutely crucial lifeline. I think the other question about comms is really interesting. This episode and natural disaster has revealed very dramatically how vulnerable internet connections are, especially to remote island communities like Tonga, which is dependent on a single underwater cable. And it's not really clear how to improve that sort of infrastructure going forward. It's an incredibly complex operation to try and reconnect the cable, which is about the size of a garden hose, which was split in the eruption. And, you know, we don't know how many miles apart the two ends of that hose actually are. And it'll take very specialized divers and crews to hoist each end of the cable, if they find the cable, onto the boats, and a very difficult technical operation to reconnect them. And that in itself raises big questions about the internet's infrastructure. I mean, worldwide, there are about more than 400 cables spanning millions of miles. And of course, richer countries that have and attract investment from big tech, you know, Google, for example, has been moving into this particular area for years. But, you know, what happens with isolated communities? Because, frankly, for 100,000 people, there's not much interest in improving that infrastructure. I think Elon Musk is offering to send Starlink terminals to Tonga. He says he's waiting to hear if they're needed to help restore connectivity. But, you know, the whole question of how these undersea cables works is fascinating, but it does reveal a degree of vulnerability, because other things attack them too. You know, things like sharks periodically nibble through these cables under the sea. Construction can interfere with them. So it's complex.
Well, let's turn now to Afghanistan. On Wednesday, the U.S. military declassified videos of an August drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians in Kabul. This dates back to last summer's chaotic U.S. withdrawal from the country, and how the U.S. military responded after a suicide bomber killed 13 U.S. service members and dozens of Afghans at the entrance to the Kabul airport. Dave, what new details did we learn from this footage?
So I had a look at this footage. It's really eerie to watch the minutes leading up to this attack, which was basically a case of mistaken identity. The Pentagon initially said they'd struck an ISIS-K terrorist who was planning an attack at the airport. You'll remember that just a couple of days before this, there was a suicide bombing at the airport, so they were on very high alert. But actually, the person who was killed was an aid worker, and he was arriving home or to a house where his relatives lived. Some kids ran out to greet him, and in the end, 10 people were killed, including 7 children. It was a horrific incident, and it did take reporting from the New York Times to let us know exactly what happened. It wasn't the Pentagon that initially came out with the mea culpa. It was journalism that told us what happened here. And actually, the New York Times filed a Freedom of Information Act request for additional information, and the Pentagon did declassify this video. They've apologized to the family, and they've said that it was basically an honest mistake, and nobody has been punished over it. But they've said that, you know, lessons have been learned, basically.
Nina Maria, briefly, what reasons did the Pentagon give for deciding not to punish any of those responsible?
Well, it's very unclear. I think the key question is, was this strike indicative of a wider trend? And I think that's the concern. And, you know, is there room for President Biden to change his counterterrorism strategy, which is something that congressional Democrats are calling for? There are deep concerns over what you know, the fear is that these are repeated civilian casualties, you know, and that there are a whole raft, perhaps, of secretive and unaccountable lethal operations that we don't know about. And, I mean, the data that has been collected, as Dave said, you know, largely through journalistic efforts, seems to suggest that we don't really know what the tipping point is.
Well, on Thursday, NPR's A. Martinez spoke to America's Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. John Sopko shared new details about a declassified report that warned the Afghan Air Force would collapse without U.S. support.
We've recommended that the Defense Department come up with a plan and implement a plan to support the Afghan Air Force. And you have to ask the Defense Department why they didn't do that. But they knew, going back to 2013, that without U.S. and contractors and enablers, the Air Force would collapse. And they knew that if the Air Force collapsed, the Afghan military would collapse.
So we've likely seen the video of the aircraft equipment that the U.S. intentionally destroyed when it pulled out of Bagram Air Base in Kabul. But I'm curious what concerns would the Defense Department have had that had it provided more support, a lot of this hardware might now be in the hands of the Taliban. Dave?
That was certainly a major factor in the decision-making there. And there are a lot of questions to be asked. You know, the way that this fighting was unfolding before the U.S. pulled out was really the Afghan forces were doing a lot of the ground fighting with U.S. air support. Now, obviously, when the U.S. left, that was, you know, not going to be there. But what this reporting makes clear is that there was going to be no air support whatsoever. And so the way that the Afghan military had been trained to fight and was fighting, that method of warfare was really not available to them without closer U.S. assistance. There was obviously also the morale factor that has really been touched on, that you know, with the U.S. Pulling out, the Afghan forces felt, some of them felt that the writing was on the wall and they were better off either cutting a deal or getting out of there. So, you know, I think that this is a reminder that there's still a sort of big autopsy to be done about the way in which the U.S. withdrew and how Kabul ended up falling so, so much faster than any of us anticipated at the time.
Well, let's update you on a story that played out last weekend in Texas. Reports say the man who took hostages at a Dallas area synagogue on Saturday wanted U.S. authorities to free a Pakistani woman being held in federal prison in Fort Worth for trying to kill American soldiers. The 11-hour standoff ended when the hostages made their escape. Then the FBI killed the British suspect. Nina Maria, what more can you tell us about both the hostage taker and Afia Siddiqui?
Well, her name, Lady Al-Qaeda, as she's known widely, has cropped up several times over the years. And during the course of her lengthy prison sentence in Texas, she's been used as a kind of perennial bargaining chip. She's a Pakistani national linked to Al-Qaeda. She was convicted in 2010 for attempting to kill Americans in Afghanistan. She's been linked to the 9/11 ringleader, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And she was on the FBI's most wanted list. She reportedly worked for a courier for him, was briefly married to his nephew, who is a Guantanamo Bay prisoner accused of sending money to the 9/11 hijackers. She was educated in the U.S. She studied at MIT. She was a neuroscientist. She has a doctorate. And she was arrested in 2008 in Afghanistan carrying sodium cyanide and a whole raft of instructions on how to make chemical weapons, how to weaponize Ebola, for instance. And when the FBI and interrogators went to question her, she grabbed an M4 assault rifle, which was left on a table, and she fired on the U.S. interrogators. Pakistan had asked for a trade in 2012 in return for Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who had been missing since 2009. He was believed to be held in Pakistan by the Taliban at the time. President Obama's national security said no to that swap. And then IS terrorists, the ones that murdered James Foley, had demanded her release to spare his life. She's currently serving an 86-year sentence. Sort of her supporters, I guess, have said that she's been wrongly accused, which brings me, I guess, to the hostage taker, who is British, was British, and big questions about how he was allowed into the United States. He was under investigation by MI5 as a possible terror threat as recently as 2020, but the case was closed after he was deemed to be no longer a threat. So both Brits and the US administration are working together now to try and understand how he fell through the gaps.
Now, there were some arrests made in the UK, which police say are connected to this standoff in Texas. Nina Maria, help us understand that connection.
Well, on Tuesday, two British teenagers were arrested in Manchester. They were questioned to see if they knew anything about him and his intentions. They were released. Then two men were arrested in Birmingham and Manchester. They were brought in for questioning on Thursday morning. That was according to the Manchester police. He's in his 40s. He's from Blackburn in the UK. Family members say that he's got a history of mental health problems. And in fact, there's this awful audio recording of the final conversation between him and his younger brother, in which his younger brother was trying to get him to surrender while the hostage taking was underway. So that's pretty much as far as we've got. He's got he has a criminal record in the UK, but no terror convictions as far as we know.
Well, this week, a German law firm investigating the Catholic Church's handling of a child sexual abuse case says former Pope Benedict failed to take action against known abusive priests. The report published on Thursday contradicts Benedict's long-running denial that he covered up or ignored abuse. For much of the time in question, he was known as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. Two of the cases date back to his time working in Munich in the late 1970s through to the early 80s. Another story in Europe, historians have spent nearly a century wondering how Nazis discovered the hiding place of Anne Frank and her family. A new team of researchers investigated the mystery, led by former FBI detective Vince Pankoek. He spoke to 60 Minutes this week about their mission.
I think that people that are looking at this feel, maybe we can learn something if this case is solved. And maybe to the Holocaust survivors that are still out there, they understand that somebody still cares that these mysteries are solved.
But Holocaust scholars are publicly questioning their methods and their conclusion that Arnold Vandenberg, a Jewish notary from Amsterdam, is to blame. David, how credible is this new reporting?
Yes, so this is not a new theory. This actually, Anne Frank's father, who was the only member of the family to survive, received an anonymous note after the war claiming that Vandenberg was the man who had betrayed the family. That's really a lot of what this new investigation is hinging their conclusion on, although they say they've discovered new evidence about a list of Jewish families being held at the time. And so they think that is another indication that the person who betrayed them could have been, Vandenberg, who, as you mentioned, was a Jew. That's obviously a very explosive claim. Their idea is that he would have been turning people over in order to protect his own family. But again, this is a circumstantial case that historians who have been looking at this for decades have really cast doubt on and say there's not certainly a strong enough available case out there to conclude that this is the person who betrayed Anne Frank's family.
Well, the research team used new crime-solving techniques like artificial intelligence. Dave, how much can you tell us about how they actually went about this investigation?
Yeah, so they had certainly a level of funding and sophistication that maybe past people who've looked at this didn't have, although from what I've seen, ultimately they made their conclusions based on not based on artificial intelligence, not based on some newly available, DNA techniques or things. This was really going back over the old evidence, pulling together a couple other threads and then coming to this conclusion. So, what I've read is mainly from the perspective of scholars who really don't necessarily buy this conclusion, although obviously, you played the clip of the investigator and he says that it is a circumstantial case, but it's the best explanation that's available.
It's the Friday News Roundup. We're with Dave Lawler, World News Editor for Axios, and Nina Maria Potts, the Global News Director for Feature Story News. One story to watch in the days ahead in the Middle East. Israeli police evicted two Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah on Wednesday. The homes in East Jerusalem were then demolished with plans to build a school there. Previous attempts to evict other Palestinians from this neighborhood stirred tensions, and that led to a renewed conflict last year between Israel and Hamas, the militant Islamist group in Gaza. According to local media, one senior Hamas official called for a new Palestinian uprising in response to these latest evictions. Let's turn to one last story today. The Australian Open Tennis Championship got underway on Monday, but hours before, a court rejected a bid by the men's world number one tennis player to stay and play. In a written statement, the judges said the government had every right to deport Novak Djokovic due to concerns the unvaccinated Serbian star could pose a risk to public health and order. So what are the chances of Novak playing in the competition next year? That was a question for Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who spoke to 2GB Radio.
What has he got to do to be welcomed back next year? Get vaccinated, well, I suppose.
Well, that's a very good point. And I'm not going to precondition any of that, say anything that would not enable the minister to make the various calls they have to make. I mean, it does go over a three-year period, but there is the opportunity for them to return in the right circumstances, and that would be considered at the time.
Nina Maria, first, just remind us how much back and forth happened between Djokovic and the Australian government.
Well, there's no question that Australia seems to have mucked it up. But for anyone that has ever been to Australia, it's kind of no surprise. I mean, pretty much when you go through immigration, the mud on your shoes is pretty much analysed. And, you know, it's pretty strict. I think if you look at the judge's ruling from the Federal Court of Australia, they ended up upholding the immigration minister's assertion that Djokovic is a role model, that his decision to stay unvaccinated could foster anti-vaccination sentiment. I think if you're considering whether Australia bungled its handling of this drama, it does raise a raft of questions over immigration, over the role of celebrities, the question of freedom of choice versus your social responsibility, and the extent to which governments should be mandating vaccines. But to the question of whether or not he'll be able to play future Grand Slams, I think at the moment that's about as clear as mud. You know, that the French initially said yes to the French Open if he wasn't vaccinated, but unvaccinated people are allowed to enter the country even if there are tougher restrictions. Wimbledon at the moment, if you're unvaccinated, you can enter the country, but it involves quarantine and testing. The US Open arguably could be a lot more difficult for him because travelers to the US, if you're not a US citizen or a permanent resident, or if you're not on an immigrant visa, then you can't enter if you're unvaccinated.
Dave, your thoughts. Do you think Australia mucked up the response, to use Nina Maria's terms? Because there was quite a bit of pushback because, as I understand it, Djokovic was let into the country without undergoing quarantine. And as we know, Omicron is rampant in so many countries right now, and it's straining hospitals and resources.
Right. So the issue here was that Djokovic was given initially given an exemption to be able to enter the country because he said that he had recently had COVID. There's quite a strict border policy in Australia, one of the strictest in the world to do with COVID. And so there was immediate backlash at the government at the idea that there was one rule for Djokovic, another for everybody else. And so the government, maybe in response to some of that pressure, decided to step in here. We had all this back and forth that ended with Djokovic finally being, expelled just when he was about to play in his match. The sporting stakes here are the fact that he is tied for the most Grand Slam championships ever. Rafael Nadal, another player who's in the tournament, has also 20 Grand Slams, but Djokovic is at the top of his game. He's the favorite when he enters all of these tournaments. He's now missed one. He could, as Nina Maria was laying out, miss others this year. And so, there's also the geopolitical stakes. Serbia is very unhappy about this, but the sporting consequences of this decision are quite interesting.
Well, we have just about a minute left here, and I'd love to hear from each of you a story you're following or a story from around the world that you think didn't get enough attention this week. Nina Maria, go ahead.
Well, we're tracking very closely the situation with Omicron in Africa and Latin America, and looking at vaccine hesitancy once again, and vaccine dumping, which has been an issue for several African countries. And, you know, our teams, we have 9 bureaus in Africa, and we've got a team in Caracas, and unfortunately, COVID is still raging, and the risk of infection, you know, this question about how severe or not Omicron is, it's certainly impacting economies, countries, and people all around the world. So that's our area of focus for now.
Dave, what about for you?
I'll stick in Africa for now. In Mali, in Northwest Africa, the government there is increasingly isolated from its neighbors. There are sanctions in place because this ruling military junta that did a coup there is now delaying elections until 2025. They've also brought in Russian mercenaries, according to the U.S., so the situation there is certainly one to keep an eye on.
That's Dave Lawler. He's World News Editor for Axios. Also with us today, Nina Maria Potts, the Global News Director for Feature Story News. And we were joined earlier in the hour by Greg Myrie, NPR's National Security Correspondent. Dave, Nina Maria, thanks for speaking with us. Barb Anguiano produces the 1A podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we will talk more soon. This is 1A.